From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, we continue our extended special coverage of the sweeping election code overhaul in the Texas legislature, which experts have determined will make voting more difficult in the state and weaken democracy in Texas and the nation.
Creating rules that, for example, more urban areas to have lower numbers of polling places per capita, that sort of thing has a racial dynamic that is similar to Jim Crow in that way.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week at the Texas Capitol, the Republican-led legislature had a historic week for advancing a battery of issues celebrated by their right-wing base. Bills that were passed will essentially outlaw abortion in Texas, transgender children will be barred from school sports, permitless carry of guns advanced, there's a crackdown on the efforts to reform the cash bail system, and much more. But one item that remains undeterred by the Republican lawmakers, despite public outcry, is a set of bills that will restrict voting. Later, we're going to hear about how voting restrictions and the weakening of civil rights is part of a national strategy. And we're going to hear about how this impacts voters who are disabled. But first, Scott Braddock is one of the best-sourced reporters covering Texas state government and the legislature. He is the editor of the Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics.
The mood at the legislature right now is sort of scattershot. And what I mean by that is you had a legislative session that started out very focused on just a couple of things. As you know, the Speaker of the House, Dade Phelan from Beaumont, had said that COVID-19 was going to color everything that they did. Well, I'm not sure what abortion regulations or voting restrictions or restrictions on transgendered folks or any of that stuff. None of it has anything to do with COVID. And so we now start to see a red meat festival, basically, at the Texas Capitol, where you have Republican office holders who are trying to check boxes, trying to make sure that when they run their next campaigns, they'll be able to introduce themselves to voters as the true conservatives in their primaries come next March.
Now, you mentioned the voting restrictions. It's being called voter integrity by the Republican lawmakers that are pushing these items. How extensive are these bills, and does it seem like they're on a greased path towards becoming law?
The governor, the speaker, and the lieutenant governor all support some form of this, although the details is that's where the devil lives, right? So I do believe that some form of new voting restrictions is going to pass and become the law in Texas. Those restrictions will probably be challenged in court. This is something that is ongoing, a natural tension between what happens with the legislature and what happens in federal courtrooms on a whole host of issues. The Texas Senate passed a bill called SB 7, which you know, and House Bill 6 is moving in the lower chamber. The details of the two bills very different, but to your question, I do think some form of this is going to pass. The question is going to be legislatively, what do the House and Senate leadership agree on, and then send to Governor Abbott?
If you don't live in a major metropolitan area in Texas, an urban area, particularly Harris County, are you going to see an impact from these bills?
The Texas Senate legislation takes specific aim at drive-through voting, 24-hour voting, the things that were being done in Harris County. I do expect that the Texas House will agree that some of the innovative things that were done in Houston to try to accommodate people during the pandemic, that those things should not be the norm. So I think if you live in a rural area, you're probably not going to see much impact from this.
You've heard a lot of testimony during these hearings on voting restriction bills that are moving through. How does making voting more convenient with drive-through voting, 24-hour voting, more drop-off locations, what is the connection, according to the testimony you've heard, between that and voter fraud?
Well, there almost is no voter fraud in this state or anywhere in the country. And to get right to the point of your question and right to the whole point of this entire issue, what you have from the Republicans who support this and from activists who support voting restrictions, there is a paranoia that there is something happening that is not happening. There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud. You can't find cases of it all over Texas or all over the country. And you do have a base of a Republican Party. And this is, seen in the testimony from various people. And it's said by certain politicians as well, that somehow former President Trump got a raw deal in 2020. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick went out of his way to point to the 2016 and 2020 elections as reasons that the general public, that Americans don't have faith in their elections anymore. At the very same time, both Patrick and Senator Brian Hughes, the author of Senate Bill 7, they have argued this is not about 2020. They say it's just about securing our elections. Leaves you scratching your head a little bit when Patrick and others will say that in Texas, Republican leadership has been able to increase voter turnout while securing the vote. Well, if turnout is up and the vote is secure, then why do we need anything else?
So we started off by mentioning all of these right-wing initiatives that have found really strong legs in the legislature, mm-hmm. expansion of gun rights, crackdowns on cash bail system, anti-transgender bills, all sorts of things like that. I'm wondering if there is a connection between voting restrictions and this new ability to get these bills passed, because they feel like these voting restrictions will dampen their opposition at the ballot box so they can swing harder to the right when it actually comes to getting the work done in the legislature. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there may be some connection on that front. What I would say about it is that for all of those issues that you mentioned, they are all boxes that can be checked in Republican primary campaigns, including the voting restrictions. And think about this, David. At some point later this year, we will once again break out the crayons and redraw the political districts of Texas. It's redistricting time. And during redistricting, what lawmakers do is they optimize the districts that they represent for the Texas House and Senate and State Board of Education, as well as our congressional delegation. They optimize those districts for partisan advantage. Some of these districts are set up to elect Republicans, some are set up to elect Democrats. And in changing those districts, which in some places they're going to have to do some dramatic changes because of the explosive growth, especially in places like Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth, they will be running for re-election in neighborhoods they've never run for re-election for, in before. And so they have to completely reintroduce themselves to conservative voters. And what they want to be able to do is say to those conservative voters, look, I voted for, as they would put it, voting integrity, these transgender restrictions, Second Amendment protections, abortion restrictions, et cetera, because those voters who don't know anything about these Republican incumbents will rely on the questions about whether they agree with those incumbents on those issues. And really, it is an incumbent protection program.
Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics. As Republican lawmakers push for voting restrictions in the name of voter security, they frequently cite the need to protect the voting rights of those who live with disability. Many of them are challenged when it comes to accessing a conventional ballot, so they will frequently rely on assistance to exercise their franchise. This has been identified as a weak link in voter integrity, and it's been targeted by the legislature with new laws and harsh criminal penalties. Jeff Miller is with Disability Rights Texas.
Voters with disabilities are like everybody else. They just want to vote, and they want their vote to count. So election integrity and security is really important to voters with disabilities as well as everybody else. The issue is that we differ in the way that these bills go about trying to achieve that. And we're really afraid that what we are seeing in the legislation that's being proposed is that voters with disabilities are being treated as suspect because they're voters with disabilities. And the people that assist them are seen as predatory or questionable or the suspect in some way, that if they're offering to help somebody with a disability vote, that must mean that they want something for that, that there's some ulterior motive.
The chair of the Elections Committee in the House, Briscoe Kane, has said that these are some of our most vulnerable Texans. We need to protect them. They're being exploited. Right. by nefarious individuals who want to steal their vote. And so this is something that Texas is coming together to, in order to do, to protect. And this is a good thing that we're doing for members of our community who are disabled. Did y'all ask for this?
It's interesting that Chair Kane describes it that way, because no one from the disability community was asked at all by his office when this legislation was in development. It wasn't until after it had been filed that we met with his office and explained some of our concerns and that sort of thing. And there's been a few tweaks made around the edges, but no real difference. In all of the testimony and all the hearings we've had so far for HB 6 and SB 7, I don't think there's been any testimony from a voter with a disability about having this problem of someone taking advantage of them.
There are some people who think that voters who are disabled are a Democratic bloc because they typically get checks from the government. Is that true?
No. Voters with disabilities are demographically just about split like the population, because to have a disability doesn't mean that you're necessarily that you're someone that gets a check from the government and is on Medicaid and you don't work and whatever. Most voters with disabilities are people like everybody else that go to work and have a job and pay their taxes and are involved in the local PTA and go to school board meetings and all those sorts of things.
What is being proposed that is going to make it more difficult to vote if you're an individual dealing with a disability?
The two major areas of things that are happening is we are asking voters with disabilities to take additional affirmations and pledges and sign new forms that, although right now, if I'm a voter with a disability and I either want somebody to assist me or I want to vote by mail because of a disability, I have to sign a statement that I'm qualified to do that, that I meet the definition in the law to do that under penalty of perjury. And that's the way it's been for a long time. Now we're saying not only do I sign that statement, but I'm in both the House and the Senate version of these bills. There's a proposal that I have to sign additional statements affirming that my disability is a certain way and affirming that I qualify to have assistance because of the disability and has definitions.
So SB 7 would also prevent counties from extending early voting hours, would ban drive-through voting, prohibit counties from using grant money to administer elections. All of these things, they're not really targeting people who have disabilities, but this, I guess, could also impact them.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about a lot of voters with disabilities, there is a larger percentage of voters with disabilities that are lower income. And so transportation is a real issue. A lot of people with disabilities have loved ones that work, and they are who the person with a disability depends on for transportation. So having access to polling, you know, at weird hours actually is beneficial, because if my family member has been at work till 5 and then they come home and we try to get to a poll, it may be 8:30 or 9:30 or 10 o'clock, or if they work the late shift even later. And that's my only way to get to a poll, because where I live, there's not an accessible transportation available. All of those little things, because, you know, when I guess I started with my premise that voters with disabilities are voters. So all the things that impact regular voters are going to impact people with disabilities. And then these additional things even add to the new complications that these new rules are going to bring.
Jeff Miller is with Disability Rights Texas. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. As the Republican leadership of Texas pushes for restricting voting in state elections, Texas isn't alone. Republican-led states across the nation are seeing similar actions, most notably Georgia. It is there that new restrictions on voting include outlawing the distribution of water for those waiting in line to vote. All of these efforts to constrict voting rights in multiple states is part of a national strategy. That's according to Jake Grumbach, a political scientist at the University of Washington. Grumbach says these restrictive voting laws follow a pattern and a much broader trend. He says the Republican Party, despite losing elections, is not interested in modifying its platform to appeal to a broader spectrum of voters because its current base won't allow it. The current GOP political base is made up of corporate interests who want low taxes and minimum government regulation, and rank-and-file voters who reject multiracial democracy. Grumbach developed a state democracy index for measuring the health of democratic institutions across all 50 states and has found that under Republican control, the right to vote is under attack and democracy is being weakened.
I collect basically all the data I can on states' election administration and electoral policies. So put that all into this statistical model, a measurement model creates this measure of democratic performance across the states from 2000 to 2018 with this measure that there are major changes going on in states' democratic performance over the past couple decades.
This is not your gut feeling about, well, things look pretty spiffy down over there in Minnesota, but they look rocky down in Texas. You have these specific metrics that you follow and they go into a model. Can you sort of look at that and see whether or not objectively how healthy these state democracies are?
Well said. So it puts minimal sort of intervention from the researcher on how to define democracy. The goal is to have minimal sort of researcher intervention.
So that said, how are we doing?
Texas has been below the median and experienced some fluctuations across time as it changed its districting and the amount of gerrymandering and sort of bias in its districting. And as it changed some election laws and there were changes in sort of how long people waited in line at the polls and things like that. But overall, it hasn't actually changed its position or its democratic performance as much as some other states. It's tended to be sort of slightly below average and remained about there through the past couple of decades, though these bills now under discussion in the state legislature may change its sort of democratic performance moving forward by, for example, increasing wait times for voting by, you know, the potential rule of having just no 24-hour ballot drop boxes and the county by county polling place rule in one of the bills. If they affect something like people's wait times for voting, or and also there's new restrictions on people's ability to claim disability to get a mail ballot in Texas being considered, those type of things would reduce its democratic performance.
What's an acceptable amount of time that someone should be expected to wait to go vote before they have been suppressed?
That's a great question. I'd say voter suppression, there's no sort of bright threshold line, but I say any time waiting to vote is a problem and increases the costs of voting and can be a way to suppress it. So I'd say like voter suppression is a spectrum, and waiting, the more you wait, the more suppressed your vote is by increasing the burden on you, the voter.
So in your index where you score 61 indicators of voting rights and civil liberties, I guess, do you look at the pervasiveness of voter fraud in that index?
In the U.S., it's so statistically negligible and doesn't vary by state that it, you know, I can certainly put it in the model and nothing would happen. Yeah.
So in the United States, then, what you see as an academic who studies this, that voter fraud is such an insignificant factor in the outcome of elections that it's not even worth looking at.
In the U.S., there's a consistent finding of essentially no voter fraud. And you can see also, like, theoretically, I do, like, there are stiff penalties for voter fraud as well. So highly irrational to do voter fraud as well from the individual perspective.
A lot of people are talking about what we're seeing now in these states around the country that are cracking down on making voting harder. They're calling this Jim Crow 2.0. And there's a debate about whether or not that's a misrepresentation. And Jim Crow is a very specific thing that happened in the South. Jim Crow looks different than what we're seeing right now, or does it?
That's a tremendously good question. So a couple things. So I'd say the analogy to Jim Crow, I'd say on the one hand, there's some it makes sense that people would apply that term because voter suppression right now, given the past generation of racial sorting of the electorate, where the parties have become more racially homogenous in their electorates, that means that it's easier to target through, for example, gerrymandering. One of the ways to best predict somebody's partisanship is through their racial identity. So a way to, you know, gerrymander out the other party is to target voters of a particular race and other demographic characteristics like that. So there's certainly at the forefront, a racial dimension of state level democracy. And also just in opposite, you know, sort of many of the coalitions fighting against expanding access to voting themselves are seem pretty clearly against the idea of multiracial democracy in the US. But the reason I don't think the Jim Crow analogy is very apt in this case is that Jim Crow, like you sort of implied in your question, Jim Crow, racial conflict and economic conflict under Jim Crow were much more localized. So in my own research now, I'm finding that really you can tell how a state's democracy is going to perform based on, you know, conflict in national politics. So now the parties are much more coordinated at the national level. So you know what Republicans or Democrats are going to be doing regardless of what state they're from. If you're a Democrat, you're like Democrats across the country, Republican like Republicans across the country. That's much more true than a generation ago when there used to be Southern conservative Democrats, for example. So that's why this is really different from Jim Crow, because it's over national conflict rather than a state or local level conflict over, for example, racial hierarchy, land and land redistribution, desegregation of schooling, right, which is a mostly a local political issue. It's very different now in that it's highly nationalized. It's national politics playing out through the state level.
Yeah. And then looking at the tactics of Jim Crow, you know, we saw literacy tests and poll tax, and people do make a direct comparison to that to some of what's being required now to go vote.
That's a good point. So I'd say there's some similarity to Jim Crow election administration in that Jim Crow was specifically designed. The reason it was constitutional at the time is that it did not specifically mention race or have racial bias within its construction of the laws formally and legally, and then they were implemented in racially biased ways or in ways that they knew the consequence would be to disenfranchise Black voters. So it's similar today where, for example, targeting specific, creating rules that make it, for example, more urban areas to have lower numbers of polling places per capita. That sort of thing has a racial dynamic that is similar to Jim Crow in that way.
Jake Grumbach is a political scientist at the University of Washington. What's happening in the state legislature today, race-based attacks on voting and civil rights, this is not new. This is as old as the founding of Texas itself and has continued to be a dominant theme in the development of the state, the crafting of its state laws and its institutions. Longtime Texas-based reporter and author Bill Minutaglio makes that case in his new book, A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles, The History of Politics and Race in Texas.
I happen to think, just based on working on the book and being in Texas as a writer and journalist, book writer for, almost 45 years now, I've always felt that race, like it is in many other places around the nation, but particularly in Texas, that race was always underappreciated or undervalued in terms of the evolution of Texas history and Texas politics and just the way we view it and understand it. It's really almost a jackboot imprint on the evolution of the political system in Texas. It certainly carries forward to today. You can see the roots and the threads and the connections. And I really do think we're seeing some patterns, from the 1800s still being played out today.
One person that kind of fascinates me in Texas history is John Connally. Mm-hmm. How he went from being the right-hand man for LBJ in the car with the assassination of JFK to being the person that Nixon wanted to appoint as his vice president and when Agnew was going down the tubes. Mm-hmm. he was a person that kind of like stood still. Nothing changed. He was just still John Connally. The political labels just moved all around him.
He's symbolic of, to me, along with a few other folks, was just the transition nominally, the way the conservative wing of things in Texas just changed nominally. They had been Southern Democrats, and then they became Southern Republicans, I suppose, for lack of a better term. And he was just someone who made that shift. Connally was a bridge. And he was really just always, I suppose, what you, if you think of a Republican today, he was one way back when, but just happened to be, listed or was nominally a Democrat. There was one anecdote about a long march of farm workers in the Rio Grande Valley were going to make a march all the way from the Rio Grande Valley to the state capitol, basically to suggest that they were underpaid. They were subject to abuses out in the fields. Citrus field owners for whom they were working were hiring Texas Rangers and off-duty police to kind of just crack down on them as they tried to organize. So there was a group of people that were going to make this, very hopefully publicly recognized march, and they were literally going to walk from the valley to the steps of the state capitol and see if they can get some relief. Connally, he was really honked. He was really pissed that a group of Latino farm workers were going to be marching to his state house and sit there on the steps and bitch and moan at him about the need for better representation and better care and attention. So he hopped in his car with some Texas Rangers, and he intercepted the group before they could get to the city limits of Austin and railed at them and yelled at them. And by this point, the folks were unbelievably haggard. They literally had walked. They were going through communities, and people were giving them food and water, new clothing, better shoes. It was really like a dramatic moment, I would say, and maybe not just Texas history, but American history. And unfolding in Texas. But I was really struck by Connally's reaction rather than handling it even diplomatically, letting them come and then blowing some smoke at them and saying, yeah, you know, well, take a look at all of this and I applaud your efforts. I salute your culture and yada, yada, yada. He aggressively drove down to intercept them and basically tell them you really shouldn't go to Austin. They actually did. They continued on. Which probably further angered him. But I thought it was a small, maybe not small, but an important symbolic, bit of evidence about where Connally was coming from, because he's important in terms of Texas history as the bridge to the modern Republican Party and really setting in motion a lot of the folks who we see in power today and sort of the vice grip that the Republican Party has on Texas. You can thank, credit or thank or blame, John Connally for that.
Bill Minutaglio is a veteran Texas journalist and author of numerous books about Texas. His latest is A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles, A History of Texas Politics and Race in Texas. It's published by the University of Texas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you'll find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.